This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to a new year and a new series of Better Places with me, Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
And me, Luke Francis.
First one of the year. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Everybody had good breaks, good trips.
What did you get up to?
Well, we were on our very delayed honeymoon. And so we ended up going across to the other side of the world, which was great. So we did Singapore, New Zealand and Fiji. So very lucky, very odd having a hot Christmas. But don't worry, I was brought crashing back down to reality at a rainy Heathrow when we arrived. All a distant memory now, but ready to get going. What about you? What did you do for Christmas?
I got engaged.
You did get engaged.
Lovely little Christmas present.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can't believe she said yes.
Yeah, neither can I.
Many of us can't believe it.
But that is binding now. and then we went to Hawaii. Everyone's going to switch off by this point.
Yeah, I know. I'm not listening. Who are these people?
Yeah.
No, so it was good Christmases for both of us. Nice. But we're ready to go, ready to be back, and ready to deliver. So, no. We are back with a good episode, and actually a little bit of a cheat here because we did record the interview with our guest, Dr. Nick Bowes, before Christmas. And actually, it's all about housing. And I would say that whilst many things get forgotten in the Christmas holidays, housing is not one of them because it's become an even bigger issue than it was before. House price volatility, under delivery of housing. And a whole range of other problems, which it'll be good to get his take on. So it's a really interesting interview, and actually that's what we're going to talk about today, all about housing. So, I mean, a couple of stories. You know, we start these with a couple of things that we've picked up, and actually there's no shortage of stories relating to housing at the moment, but I suppose the big one is the change just before Christmas that the government sort of dropping the mandatory aspect of the housing target.
That'll help.
Which, I mean, it's sort of, well, it's just terrible, really, because I think a lot of people in the industry and a lot of people around this feel that the target has been the one thing that's actually been delivering homes over the last few years. And so for it to fall back and no longer be a mandatory target, which I think is where it's heading, as I understand it correctly, has already had implications because quite a few local authorities have now said that they are pausing their local plans to wait for the outcome of this review of the MPPF. And I think, you know, there was a study by Lichfields recently that said that I think 33 councils have either stopped or cut their house building plans in the last 2 years. The shortfall of what we need to deliver versus what's actually being delivered just gets bigger and bigger.
And I think from a political perspective, this was always a bit of a shield for local authorities, right? This is always a shield for councils who, you know, at a base level, we have to build the homes. This is the target we have to build to. They have to go somewhere in the borough. It's always been that sort of safety net, particularly in the work we've done. And actually to remove that, it creates an even sort of bigger political football when it comes to delivering homes in boroughs because there isn't that base level requirement for councils to deliver.
No, and I think the politics of this just becomes harder and harder as you head towards, you know, any kind of general election, to be honest, because you've got a lot of backbench MPs, particularly on the Conservative side, who, you know, are getting quite a lot of opposition from local residents about, you know, building significant homes in certain communities, and are kind of then getting panicked and reflecting that by lobbying central government to drop these kind of targets and water it down, all the while every year that we don't build these homes is another year that, you know, actually people are going to struggle to get on the ladder. And, you know, for Conservatives, I do think it's slightly shameful, really, in a way, given the fact that it's such a fundamental tenet of what it means to be a Conservative, which is owning your own home, and you just sort of lock out an entire generation.
And it's not just a Tory headache. So we'll move on to the story that I've picked out, which is Sadiq Khan potentially having to return up to £50 million to central government because of the shortfall in the number of affordable homes that were started in London between 2016 and 2023. So he was given a budget of £4.8 billion.
To build affordable homes?
Yeah, to build 116,000 affordable homes over that seven-year period. On the last count, it was at 94,000, just over 94,000, so a shortfall of around 22,000 homes. And one of the solutions being put forward is that City Hall, the Mayor of London, buy up some of the existing properties that developers are struggling to sell at the minute and put that 50 million towards purchasing pre-existing delivered homes to avoid having to give back that money at a time when, you know, we're desperately needing more homes to be built.
I think this goes to kind of the heart of the issue in a way, is that it's not, this isn't just money. This isn't a money problem, the under delivery of homes. This is, there is, you know, you've got a budget there, literally from central government to the mayor, go build affordable homes, and he hasn't been able to do it. And I think, you know, that is a story reflected at local authorities all over the place, because the process just takes forever.
And it ties in very nicely with the guest we're speaking to today, with Nick Bowes, who in a previous life was the director of policy at the GLA. So has first-hand experience of some of the difficulties and complexities associated with trying to get these homes built. But tying in that with the removal of those targets, it doesn't feel like the landscape's going to get any easier for house builders.
No, and I think it just takes so long. I think that's the,
you
like.
You just sound really exhausted.
Well, I just am. The reason I mention it is because a planning consultant who writes a blog saw over the weekend, it's done some analysis basically on how long it actually takes to determine major planning applications across London. And kind of the government hide behind this target of 86% of major applications are determined within 13 weeks or the agreed timescale. And you think, well, you know, if you, any of us who have been through that process, know that you just have to agree an extension on the timescale for virtually every application. And so you look down at, it's, you know, the London Data Hub, and it's James Wickham from Gerald Eve who's pulled this data out.
I wondered why you were being coy about who it was.
No, it's James Wickham from Gerald Eve who's pulled this data out. And it's actually really interesting because, you know, essentially the borough that, when you take the averages, they're all sort of in the 30 or 40 week determination time. And it just, yeah, I think that's the lived experience. And I imagine it's just becoming even worse.
Well, and there are, you know, over that period as well, you know, we're working on schemes at the minute that the viability on those schemes has changed significantly during that period. You know, costs go up, as materials and, you know, labour. That's a very long time to try and maintain a position. And actually, you know, for the vast majority of the developers working in London, they want to get these things built. You know, this isn't speculative applications. These are homes that people want to get built out as quickly as possible. And that the longer that process takes, the more difficult it is to actually get bricks in the ground.
So it is all slightly depressing, but I do wonder whether this is going to become a real big set piece of the election campaign. And I think everybody's talked a good game on housing for the last couple of elections. And as we kind of look towards, you know, the next general election, I think, you know, this is one of the big things that is creating that generational divide, I think, between those who feel that they're secure in a home and, you know, the value of that property goes up, you feel more wealthy, you feel happy about that. And, you know, those who are kind of stuck on the rental market. And that has also now, post-COVID, become a wild west. I mean, you know, we were talking to some of the people who, you know, work in our office at renting, you know, going to rent a place and having to basically turn up to a bidding war to try and, you know, highest bid. You know, if you don't do it in the first hour, you've lost the place. I mean, that's if there was ever a kind of supply and demand argument to this whole thing, that's the evidence.
And I think, you know, there was a story in City AM today that said that London house prices are back on the up after a couple of months of sort of slight decline, are now rising again. And actually that is down almost exclusively to a lack of supply and a, you know, a consistent demand, because we've seen what's happened to mortgage rates. We're both worried about mortgage rates.
Always
worried. You're never not worried about mortgage rates. But, you know, by a lot of different metrics, we should be seeing those numbers plateau, if not continue to decline slightly. But there is so much heat in the market still because of that lack of supply that it's, you know, it's hard enough to rent somewhere in London, and buying somewhere feels like an impossible dream. I think if you're in your 20s, even in your 30s, the prospect of being able to save to buy your own home is a...
Feels more distant. Feels more distant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All the time.
It's very depressing.
Well, however, you know, we do try and find solutions on this podcast.
Yeah.
And we're playing our part by trying to successfully navigate planning applications through the system.
Get in touch.
With community support and hopefully slightly accelerated schedules by working with communities rather than against them. But that is only part of the jigsaw. And as I say, our interview today is with Nick Bowes, who's the Chief Executive of the Centre for London. They are the big-time thinkers on all things London and all the policy challenges, of which housing is obviously a significant one.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was really good just to pick through the issues and go through this with Nick, as somebody who kind of understands maybe how Sadiq thinks a little bit more than most. But also just somebody who has significant experience just grappling with these issues and trying to come up with solutions. So should we listen to him?
Let's get him on.
Let's get him on.
And I'm delighted to say that we're now joined by Dr. Nick Bowes, who is the former Director of Mayoral Policy at the GLA, a visiting senior research fellow at the Policy Institute at the King's College London, and now Chief Executive of the Centre for London. Nick, thanks for coming on.
Absolute pleasure to be here.
In the interest of full disclosure, so Nick and I discussed this before we started recording, we don't have to pretend we don't know each other. We did used to work together in our previous lives, so I'm very pleased that you've been able to join us today, Nick. Thank you.
That's okay. And we did like each other as well. So
we did. We did like each other. And there is mutually assured destruction in case either of us decide to start telling stories about the other from our previous working history together. Nick, let's kick off with a bit of an explanation about Centre for London, what it is you guys do.
So Centre for London is a think tank. A think tank, for those who don't know what a think tank is a research institution that comes up with public policy solutions to a particular challenge. And in our case, it's things that affect London. We do what it says on the tin. We look at the really big thorny issues that are facing London and try and come up with new ideas, new solutions. We bring people together, we convene experts and people that have got a stake in a lot of these issues and thrash out some really quite thorny problems. We can create space to have really difficult conversations that perhaps others can't. And we've been around for about 11 years now, and I've been in charge for the last 18 months. And historically, we did a lot of work on the built environment, on housing, on architecture, public realm. We still do that work, but we also do things on transport, on the environment, on inequality. We've recently done a big project on levelling up. We really can roam wherever we like, given that we're a geographically focused think tank. But I'm really keen that we get our teeth into the really big relevant issues, of which there's no shortage at the moment.
And for anyone who hasn't come across Centre for London's work before, I'd thoroughly recommend going to the website and having a look. There's everything from reports on low traffic neighbourhoods and the implications of that through to what levelling up means for London. It's a really interesting cross-section of stuff on there, so go and have a look. But one area that we're keen to chat about today, and it's an area that Centre for London have done an awful lot of work on previously, as you say, Nick, is sort of housing and development in the capital. And I think it's a universally accepted truth that London is in the midst of a housing crisis at every level, whether it's the shortage of temporary and emergency accommodation, the condition of much of our sort of social housing, which was obviously tragically highlighted recently in the case in Rochdale. And we've got spiralling rental costs and first-time buyers being priced out of the market by soaring values. So my first question to you, I guess, Nick, is just how bad is the housing situation in London?
Well, I think you summed it up pretty well. I think things are in a really bad way. I mean, I think it is just worth putting in context that I moved to London 22 years ago, and there was a housing crisis then. You know, people felt that housing was way too expensive and there wasn't enough of it. And that's 22 years ago. Since then, there's 2 million more people live in London. And just to put that in context, that's four equivalents of Leeds being added to London in 22 years. And we've not built anywhere enough homes to keep up with that. So a problem that was a problem 23 years ago has just got worse. And I think what's exacerbated it recently is COVID and the fallout from that pandemic period, which has particularly hit the private rental sector. And I think many of those people that are renting privately, including many of the people who work for me, are facing some really shocking decisions over where they live and how much rent they pay. And it's out of control. They feel like they have no control over it. And there's a shortage of places. They've been presented with almost ultimatum circumstances where they're faced with huge increases in rents. And it's leading to turmoil.
Yeah, I mean, and we sort of read reports. We do obviously an awful lot of work here around sort of housing development and demand, and you know, increasingly, particularly in the private rented sector. You know, the competition to secure private rental accommodation is just becoming absolutely ridiculous, and you know, 30, 40 people competing for a single, you know, private rented accommodation, and you know, people being encouraged to put in bids above a certain asking price. It doesn't feel sustainable at all.
No, it's crazy. I mean, I say 22 years ago, I moved to London. Me and my friends went out at 7 o'clock in the morning, bought a copy of Loot, which some of you may remember as a newspaper, daily newspaper that you paid a pound for, and it was full of adverts on everything. But it was a place to go to find adverts for flats. The internet wasn't really used in those days. And you sat and you phoned them up and said, can I come and look at this property? You went and looked at it that day. If you liked it and you could afford to pay the rent they were asking, you just signed on a dotted line. There was no, it's everyone's going to come within an hour window and there's going to be 40-odd people there and you're all going to fight it out by offering me as a landlord as much as you're prepared to pay and as big a deposit up front as you're prepared to pay. There were no queues around the blocks for properties. I mean, the stress involved. I was shocked, actually, a couple of years ago when I heard that people bid for rental properties, because that was not the case previously. That was not the case. And I just think the uncertainty and the instability that creates. And don't forget, you know, more people rent privately in London now than own homes. I think that statistic is right. Home ownership has obviously been on the decline for quite a long time in London. It's way more people rent privately in London than anywhere else in the country. It's such a big part of the population. Yeah. So, you know, it's not a unique problem to London, but it has much more of an impact on the city than anywhere else.
Yeah, I was reading whatever my sort of one monthly free article was in either something like Bloomberg or Forbes about during economic recession as well, the demand for the private rented sector increases significantly because people can't afford to, you know, people who are saving for their first homes can't afford to buy. So yes, that demand, you know, you fully expect over the next 12, 18 months for that to increase.
Well, and I think there's a double whammy there, though, because, of course, landlords who've got multiple properties and have got mortgages, they haven't yet probably been hit by the increases in mortgage rates if they're on fixed-term mortgages. So when that starts to feed through as well, that will also drive upwards the rents that people charge because they've got to cover their mortgage payments. So, you know, the circumstances are coming together for it to get even worse.
Yeah, so we're in a bad situation and staring down the barrel of an increasingly worse one. So is the most obvious answer the right one? You know, simply we need to build more homes.
Can I be really honest with you and say that this is a really complicated problem? And if there was one single solution to it, that would be amazing. Mm-hmm. There isn't. I think there's lots of solutions, lots of things that will come together to help solve this problem, some small, some big. And the debate is not very sophisticated, actually. Clearly, building more homes is got to be a huge part of that solution. I think then the debate becomes one about whether it's a matter of just building as many homes as you can, regardless of what type of homes they are, or whether it is about building enough of the right kind of homes that we need to benefit the city and those that are most in need. I think that's often where the debate becomes.
Because I think if you're in a city as well, that you have different demands in different parts of London as well. You know, the pressure is most acute in different areas depending on where you are.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I mean, there is a shortage of family homes, and perhaps there is a surplus of one-bedroom flats that get built. There's space constraints in some parts of the city. If it is the case, as some people would say, that the whole problem of rising cost of housing is because a shortage of supply, and therefore just building more will address that, is the case, that might take quite a few years to make any inroads. And in the short term, it doesn't do much to help those on the lowest incomes that are most in need. So you can see why the argument that we need to make sure we're building the right kind of homes now is made, and is very powerful. But you're right. I mean, there are, you know, the skyline of London's changed a lot, again, in my 22 years. There were very many tall buildings in London. There are a lot more now. And, you know, huge chunks of the city that have been regenerated and transformed and continue to be so. There's an enormous amount of stuff getting built, but it's still struggling to keep up. We've never managed to keep up with the annual rise in demand, so we've fallen further and further behind every year.
And so one of the big barriers, I guess, you know, as you say, we've never really, you know, certainly as long as I can remember, we've never sort of reached the delivery targets that we know we need to reach to meet demand. And at the most recent set of local elections back in May, you know, one thing we saw was that development, particularly housing development, was really politicised. It really became a political football. And actually, in almost every area, the parties that stood on either an overtly anti-development platform or a, you know, a subtle anti-development platform around protection of identity of areas and, you know, things around sensitivities around heights did really well at those elections. Do you think London is a NIMBY city? Do you think there is a sort of predominant NIMBY agenda in London, or is it, you know, is it across the board that actually, you know, people are not particularly keen to see development in their area, but can agree that, you know, we need more houses, just not where they live?
So I think you need to unpack that quite a lot. I think to say the city's a NIMBY city is an overgeneralization. I think if you went out to the Royal Docks or to Barking Riverside and saw the 40, 50, 60,000 homes that are getting built out there, you'd see that there is enormous amounts of development taking place. And that is on the back of development that's happened in other parts of the city over the last 20 years or so. That's not to say there aren't particular bits of London where it's more difficult. That's clearly the case. I mean, some of that is aesthetic driven because some bits of the city have, you know, conservation areas, some of them have got UNESCO World Heritage Sites, and there's protected views. There's all sorts of kind of rules, frameworks and regulations that also stand in the way. But it's also one of those things where you ask Londoners, or you ask the public in general, you know, do you think we need to build more homes to deal with the fact that there's a shortage? Of course, overwhelmingly, people say yes. And the follow-up question comes, you know, do you want them to be built basically, you know, at the end of your road? Well, yeah. Support does trail off a bit. So that is the ultimate challenge. And all politics is local. I mean, all politics is local, as somebody very famous, more famous than me, once said. And when it comes to elections, that it's one of those things that people tend to campaign on. But there is a wider problem in that it is difficult to build infrastructure in this country. It's not just a London problem, and there's obviously a big debate going on about that at the moment. The previous administration running the country for that brief window, had had this phrase about the anti-growth coalition. And they tried to make out that it was actually quite a part of political thing, that somehow it was only the Labour Party and those on the left that were part of that. The thing is, the anti-growth coalition cuts across every bit of society. You know, it's as big issue in most of the political parties when it comes to campaigning, and in all bits of the country. There is a resistance in some areas. I think where you get one of the tensions in London is that it means that perhaps more of the development goes into certain bits of the city than would be the case if it was more equally spread out. And you see density and height in some of these areas, and there'll be people that live in zone 1, 2, 3 who are looking at the objection to building on station car parks in zone 6 and thinking, well, you know, I've had 3,000 new homes built 250 metres down the road from me. So, you know, it's... what's their complaint about? We're getting huge density, so it's complicated. The geography of the city is complicated. The politics is complicated, and the planning process is complicated.
And it's one of those issues that transcends political terms and political parties as well. It's whoever is in power at that time is faced with the same challenge, and it takes that long-term view, presumably, to resolve it. Because obviously you spent a lot of time in City Hall, directing policy there. What was your experience of that, sort of working, you know, the level, the role that the GLA play in the process, but you're also sort of working up and down as well with local authorities and with central government. What was your experience of it?
So we had two particular roles when it came to planning in particular. And one is, The mayor sets the strategic planning framework for the city. There are not many bits of the country where there's a regional planning document. London's one of the few. Greater Manchester's got the same. And it's an enormously powerful document because, it sets the strategic plan for the city, within which local authorities have to create their own plans and in which big schemes have got to conform. And then the second role that the mayor has is that on certain schemes over a certain height, a certain size, they go through a stage one and stage two process to make sure that they conform with the London plan. And then there is a calling power on really big schemes. So there's kind of two things. And I think when we rewrote the London plan, and for those of you who've never seen the London plan, it is the size of an old-fashioned telephone directory. We tried very hard to make sure that there was clarity around the things that the mayor was wanting to see from schemes. So developers, it was clear, you know, 35% homes you can move quick, affordable homes you can move quickly. These are the things that we're looking for. So that there was real clarity for developers, because I think that's one of the things that they get most frustrated about, the kind of lack of clarity. And the mayor was very clear that 40% affordable homes was what he would be looking for, and he would be using his calling powers to make sure the number of affordable homes got pushed up as much as possible. And I think it then did perform a more interventionist role as a result. But actually, rarely did the mayor stand in the way of developments. He didn't turn much down. He took over schemes that perhaps had been turned down locally, managed to squeeze more affordable homes out. He's actually really quite pro-development. The challenge came where the higher power above the mayor, which is basically the Secretary of State, did intervene on quite a number of schemes under certain Secretaries of State more than others. And I think that's caused quite a lot of tension, because it wasn't actually clear why they were being called in at that level. And often decisions were overturned, or it took years for it to go through the system. And you always do question, well, is there some politics in this? And which is just frustrating, because there's always a lot of pressure on London. You've got to build more, you've got your targets, you get criticised if you don't hit your targets, local authorities and GLA level. And then when schemes come forward that are building their homes, they get stopped. So it's like this real tension, and you saw it with TfL You know, Tivoli's got a lot of land in the city, and even before the pandemic was looking to sweat its assets much more by developing, building homes on a lot of its land, generating income streams for TfL. Even more important post-pandemic with the financial stresses on the organisation, the government was saying you've got to generate more of your own income. So they were bringing forward schemes, but they were getting knocked back at a local level, sometimes even called in at a national level. So there's that kind of tension. On the one hand, TfL's getting told to build more homes. On the other hand, it's getting campaigned against for building more homes. So that was, I think, quite frustrating and probably continues to be so. That you've been told to do one thing and then getting criticised for doing it at the same time.
It's really interesting. So without naming names, we worked on one of those car park schemes and had exactly that situation. Is as the environment around sort of development and delivery of new homes becomes more difficult with land values and build costs and labour shortages becomes more acute, which, you know, everything we've talked about so far suggests it probably will. Do you think we will see a more interventionist approach from, say, City Hall? You know, we've seen that at a national level, people are, Secretary of State are willing to intervene. If delivery is the priority, and you talked about local authorities having pushed back on schemes that actually on paper deliver the homes we need at the percentages that we're targeting, do you anticipate potentially a more interventionist approach from City Hall then over the next couple of years to try and get some of these developments and proposals built out?
So I think a key factor in that is that if it was to be the case that the mayor would be more interventionist, there needs to be schemes and applications coming forward for him to intervene in. And I think there's the kind of risk at the moment with the way that the economy is going and the massive rise in cost of raw materials and labour shortages, that there could well be a slowdown in the number of schemes coming forward. I mean, I've spoken to one or two developers, housing associations, who've said that you know, the pipeline is going to really start thinning out. So I think there'd be a particular challenge there. And I think the other problem that London is going to face is that London government, local authorities and mayor would argue that there's not enough public money going in to support building affordable homes. That's now. I can't see that situation getting any better over the next couple of years of tightening of belts, and probably will get worse. So actually, we're going to rely even more as a city on planning gain to deliver the types of homes that mayors and local authorities need, because it's only going to come through private schemes. There's going to be pressure on public money to build homes funded by public sector. And I think you could see a real kind of try and squeeze even more out of the private sector development. So I think you're going to have that tension of there might not be the same number coming through the system, but those coming through the system, there could be even tighter squeeze to get even more out of them in terms of affordable homes.
Do you think, because I think that's completely true, the conversations we have with developers, it's exactly the same, which is there's an increasing reliance from local authorities on private development to deliver not just the homes we need, but, you know, in the volume that we need to deliver, because local authorities just don't have the spending power to deliver them themselves. Do you think then that with those cost pressures and labour shortages and everything else, that there will be some flexibility with local authorities around some of the policy requirements? I'm thinking, you know, as a developer, you're facing these pressures. One of the ways that you solve it is by increasing heights or densities, which we know aren't popular, either sort of with local residents or sometimes with local politicians. But do you think that's an area of potential flexibility that they may have to look at over the next few years about how we deliver the homes that you need to deliver in an increasingly difficult environment?
I think that you might see a bit of that, but I guess some of that will probably be on a borough by borough basis, and I think it'll depend on the leadership of the borough, maybe even the political colour of the borough. I suspect that I mean, I know, for example, that some of the conditions that are put on the affordable housing money, which comes from the government to the GLA, is pretty strict. I mean, unnecessarily so, frankly. I mean, it's another kind of case of micromanaging from Whitehall. And I suspect that you might see some conversations taking place about whether there could be a loosening of some of the rules on that money so that we could just get homes built, because I think some of that might stifle home building over the next couple of years. Because the Treasury will want to see homes actually built. They'd rather not the money be returned unspent. But whether you'll see local authorities say, actually, you can go higher and you can have more homes on that site, because we know cost of living's pushed up prices, costs of things, possibly. But then on the other hand, if they were going to do that, they probably would do that anyway to try and get more affordable homes. So that kind of thing's probably already happening.
Yeah, if it's going to be happening somewhere, it's probably already the case. And there are, as you say, there are certain places in London that are certainly more accommodating and open to things like height and massing and you know, how you maximise a footprint of a site than others. So with your policy hat on, which is now the hat that you wear all the time, I assume, obviously, you know, your background is, you were in City Hall as Director of Mayoral Policy. You've got a PhD in economic geography. I read that. I didn't know about you. I read it on your bio on the Centre for London. But it's, so if you were given carte blanche in Westminster, in Whitehall, what would you change from a policy perspective to unlock what needs to be unlocked?
Well, that's a big question. For a minute there, I also thought you said you'd read my PhD. You'd probably be you'd be the third person in the whole world who ever had. Well, I wouldn't recommend
it.
I wouldn't recommend it. It's in the British Library if you've ever got a bit of time. So again, I don't want to sound like this is a cop out. It isn't. It is a complicated issue. There isn't one lever that I could just pull to solve this problem. There's a lot of levers. So I think that you're not going to get around solving this problem without putting more public money in over a longer period of time, because the value of land in London is so high that the affordable housing problem it's not going to be solved without an enormous amount of money going in, both to buy land and to build homes. There is a shortage of land, and a lot of that land is in private ownership, and viability becomes a real challenge. So I think that's one thing. Two, I think you do need to look at housing as a strategic issue over the wider South East and not just London. London's boundary is a false artificial political boundary. It's not a boundary in any sense, in an economic or a commuter sense. You know, 1 million people commute into London on an average day from outside of the city. In times past, there'd been a more strategic look at where you would put new homes. You know, there were new towns built around London. Towns were expanded. The volume of house building that's going on in that kind of blue donut is not fantastic. A lot of it, because it's protected by Greenbelt, but a lot of it is, you know, the things you talked about around the kind of local opposition is probably even fiercer in those areas. But I think until you start looking at it in a regional level and thinking, well, some of London's housing demand's going to have to be accommodated by other areas in that wider southeast, I think we're not going to solve the problem. I don't think you can solve it just within the city's boundaries. I think that you start to need to have a full debate and look at some of the trade-offs, because I think too often the debate is very simple, oversimplified, and very polarised, and there's no nuance. So if you want to have a debate and say, well, actually, we're not going to build on the green belt, we're not going to build on any of the green belt, okay, fine. Right, if that's your position, you might have to build taller buildings then instead, or you might have to densify the suburbs or build more around public transport networks. There's trade-offs in all of these things, and I don't think we ever have that kind of full debate to actually be able to capture that. And I would really quite like there to be a more sophisticated debate, because I think we're not really being honest about how we're going to solve this problem and actually get Londoners to understand that there are some of these trade-offs. I think, actually, weirdly, London is not a very densely populated city, particularly the centre. It really isn't. It's quite a sprawly city because, you know, you get out beyond Zone 3 and it's mostly... one like where you live out in Zone 7, the houses are, you know, one, two, maybe three story. They've got driveways. In central London, very few people live right in the centre. It's actually quite a low population compared to other big cities, but it's not as densely populated as some of the European cities. But I would also... you've got to link housing to transport. It's absolutely critical in London. There's no point in building 15,000 homes in the middle of nowhere if there's no public transport connections to it, because you're just going to create a place where people can't access jobs, they can't visit their friends and families. When the Big Thames Mead estate was built by the GLC in the 70s, many people will have seen it, been out there, seen it in films. It's very famous. Originally, it was intended that the 1970s Jubilee Line extension would have gone all the way to Thamesmead. It was going to be at the end of the Jubilee Line. And the intention was linking transport with housing. Great. They'd be able to access jobs. Of course, they ran out of money, and the Jubilee Line extension stopped at Charing Cross. And then when they revisited it in the 90s, they sent it by Canary Wharf and Stratford and didn't send it to Thamesmead. So Thamesmead was left really quite isolated in a London sense. And I think, you know, you can see the power of when big transport investment goes in London. Look at Ilford, look at Southall, look at places that have got Elizabeth Line stations. The amount of development's gone on in and around those stations is enormous. Because suddenly there's a high-frequency, high-capacity railway line connecting you to Canary Wharf, Heathrow, central London. And I think we've got to keep investing in infrastructure if we're going to be able to open up new places for homes and higher densities and do them together. Because without transport and housing, you're never going to maximise the transport investment that goes in, but B, you're not going to be able to deliver the homes.
Nick, one last question from me, because I am aware that you have to go and solve all of London's challenges, ideally this afternoon. But if we were to look ahead, let's say we reconvene on the show in 25 years' time, when I'm 45, what do you think London looks like? You know, we touched on things like the Green Belt. You know, there is fierce opposition to development on the Green Belt around that donut on those artificial London boundaries that you talked about. We look at 2050 in London. What do you think changes? Is it taller? Is it sprawling more? What does it look like?
So I think we will see more. We will see more taller buildings in certain bits of the city. And, you know, being honest, I like tall buildings in the right place. I think they've added a lot to London skyline. It was a pretty boring skyline before, actually. There was not much to look at. And I think it's added, because especially the ones that are in the right kind of areas where you've got those clusters. But I think you'll see out east, from Canary Wharf right out to the Greater London boundary, look like a mini Manhattan all the way out. If you've seen pictures of what is planned on both north and south side of the river through Newham, Greenwich, Bexley, Barking and Dagenham. I mean, it's an enormous amount of development. Big towers, really densified. So I think that will be really quite a remarkable and stunning kind of addition to the city. my fear is that we might be sat here saying, do you remember 25 years ago when we were saying that London had a housing crisis? Well, blooming heck, it's nothing on what it is now, because that's what I said it was like 22 years ago. You know, so 25 years when I'm 52, it'll be, there's a risk that we haven't solved this. And if we don't, the city's going to eat itself. I mean, it's eating itself now, yeah, because it's so expensive. People are getting pushed further out. The people that do really critical jobs that don't get paid vast salaries are having to travel further and further and further. And at some point, the city won't be able to function anymore. It's the same problem New York's having. It's the same problem Tokyo had in the late 80s, early 90s. And it not only that has two impacts. One, already deep poverty problems that London has are even worse. The fact that London's got the worst poverty in the country is because of the high housing costs. And two, its competitiveness as a place to be to set up, run, relocate a business is undermined because you can't get people to come and live here because they can't afford it. So it ends up being eaten away at both sides. And my fear is that if we don't really get our teeth into this, London might not be quite the place that it is now in 25 years.
Well, we will pencil in to reconvene in 2050 and carry on this discussion. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We'll be back every couple of weeks with a whole range of new guests for this new year. But for now, don't forget to like, subscribe, leave your comments, and no abuse. And we will see you very soon.
Stop the abuse.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.